Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is a special edition of On Point before a live audience at the Paramount Theater in Boston. To our guests in the hall and listeners around the country, welcome to On Point. For a while now, Americans have understood on some level that we need to change the way we eat, the way we cook or don't, the way we eat meat or don't, for health, for our taste buds, for the planet. Superstar food thinker, food writer, cook, columnist Mark Bittman has been on the leading edge of the push. So how's it going? Is food change catching on, or are we still anchored in a way of eating and understanding food that's led to obesity, illness, environmental damage? This hour on Point, we're sitting down with Mark Bittman to ask where he's headed, how we're doing on food. We're recording this show before a live audience at the beautiful Paramount Theater in downtown Boston. We've invited questions from our audience here and from our listeners around the country, online, on Facebook, on Twitter. We are loaded for bear, so let's go. Joining me now on stage is Mark Bittman, leading thinker and writer on food, columnist and writer for the New York Times, author of Leafy Greens, Food Matters, The Best Recipes in the World, and the best-selling How to Cook Everything. He famously ran around Spain eating with Gwyneth Paltrow and Mario Batali for the PBS series Spain on the Road Again. His new book, getting a lot of attention, is VB6, Eat Vegan Before 6 to Lose Weight and Restore Your Health for Good. Mark Bittman, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be here, Tom. Thank you.
Great to have you.
Thank you.
We welcome you. This great crowd welcomes you. We decided at the studio today that VB6 sounds like a motorcycle engine. It sounds very hip. VB6, vegan before six. We are so hip that we talked with you about this when you first wrote the column on this. I think it was a year ago or something.
Even more.
As soon as you put the idea out there, we glommed onto it. We are really curious to see how your thinking has developed, not just on this, but on the whole big picture of what's going on with food in this country. I've seen you described recently as a cross between Larry David and Julia Childs.
I think I'm the one who said that, actually.
Say it once and you can never escape it. How are you feeling tonight? A little Larry or a little Julia? Or
We'll see.
There's a lot we want to talk about. The big picture of how the ship of American eating and agriculture and food is turning or not turning is of great interest to us. But take us into your diet first. A lot of people may have heard a little about it at this point. Others may not have heard a thing yet. VB6, vegan before six. What are you talking about?
Well, you know, to really cut to the chase, what we know about food, nutrition I'm talking about here, changes all the time. And I was on a TV show yesterday where they open almost every show reading some factoid about some study about food that came out that day.
And, sure. You know, every day there's something.
We get 5 or 10 press releases a day that say this study shows this. And it's all really interesting, but none of it is conclusive. The one conclusive thing is that we don't eat enough plants. That's the one thing that's known. In the American diet, we eat too much processed food, junk food, and animal products, and not enough plants. That the science is really consistent on.
That's a pretty simple observation, boiled down to something quite minimalist, straightforward,
and consistent. Mm-hmm. So that's what the science tells us. So VB6, and I can get into this story or not as you like, but
your health was in trouble. The doctor said, "Do something, Mark. You have surgery. Do something radical. You figured it out. This was your solution."
And what this is a strategy, and it's a strategy to eat more plants. And what it is. Vegan before six means during the course of the day I eat, and now I'm recommending eating, only unprocessed plant food. So no junk food, no white flour, certainly no animal products. Yes, you can have cream in your coffee. Mm-hmm. This is the one exception that everybody's allowed.
Please, Mr. Bittman.
You know, and we'll get into this because I'm not that dogmatic, as everyone knows. But the idea is that you eat plants during the course of the day, and then at 6 o'clock at night, 7 o'clock at night, 8 o'clock at night, tonight, 10 o'clock at night, you let it rip and have whatever you want. All bets
really?
Are off.
Seriously?
All
sirloin, Twinkies?
Yeah, sirloin. So the idea is that by doing this, you've basically shifted two-thirds. You're making a rule by which you can shift two-thirds of your diet without thinking about it much. So especially if you're a person who eats animal products and junk food during the course of the day and you eliminate that, you've just changed your diet by a tremendous amount.
What did it do to your body, you, Mark Bittman?
Well, I lost something like 35 pounds. My cholesterol went back to normal. My blood sugar levels, which were bad, went back to normal. Some other only positive things, let's put it that way.
Can you guarantee that for everybody who does VB6?
I guarantee that everybody who does VB6 will see changes in their lives, yeah. I mean, some people are not overweight. It's, you know, weight is not the only issue.
Of course.
But and many people eat well already, so if they eat VB6, doesn't make any difference. All I'm saying is this is a strategy to change your diet. There are plenty of strategies to change your diet. I mean, I met someone tonight who said, look, my life is such that I really want to have eggs, bacon, stuff like that for breakfast, and I get home from work late at night, I just want a salad. So I said, well, that's great. I don't care. The time doesn't
matter. Turn it around, be bad whenever you want.
It's just a strategy. That's all it is.
Well, people wonder how you do it. I mean, we've got all kinds of questions here, but one of the first ones I saw was, what do you have for breakfast?
I mean, why is that so?
I don't know. People who like eggs and bacon. Yeah, they're looking at a pile of spinach for breakfast and saying, nah.
Well, I would say, I talk about this a lot, obviously, and I would say there's somewhere around 20%. First of all, eggs and bacon are savory, so the transition from that kind of savory breakfast to a savory breakfast that's a pound of spinach is not that weird, I don't think. I mean, you have spinach omelets, you have spinach and feta omelets. You already eat savory food. It's just that around the world, people eat, you know, Egyptians eat fava beans for breakfast, Turks eat olives for breakfast, and people eat
Chinese
rice
congee,
and beans,
sort of porridge,
rice and beans. People eat what we would have once considered weird for breakfast. I happen to like that stuff, but for those who don't, I mean, fruit salad is an obvious vegan breakfast.
Yeah.
Oatmeal is an obvious vegan breakfast. There are recipes in the book for things like a kind of sweet or savory pilaf. That's a great breakfast pilaf. I mean, all kinds of stuff with fruits or whole grains, or obviously vegetables. I mean, as it happens, I do like vegetables for breakfast, which is very convenient for me. But if you don't, obviously, there are things you can have that are on the sweet side but are still not, you know, waffles and bacon.
You know, all credit to vegans, because they were onto a big chunk of this way before much of the country. But what do they think of the way you're treating it? Because I've known some pretty doctrinaire vegans, and you're pretty casual with your vegan here,
well,
vegan there, vegan
there
nowhere.
Well, a different word. I mean, vegan's a very convenient word, and it's, you know, 10 years ago, no one knew what it meant. It's a 50-year-old word, but
yeah,
10 years ago, it wasn't that
But are
common.
They happy but with now, the way you've adopted it, or are they like, oh, Mark, you're corrupting the city?
There is no they, first of all. So,
okay. I ran into some. I thought that's collectively
it's not as if there's a president of vegans who speaks
there's not
to them. You know.
The big
so
meister?
So I have friends in... I have a friend who works at the Humane Society who's a vegan. I have a friend who works at PETA who's a vegan. And they think this is great because vegans think, many vegans think anything that gets people to eat fewer animals is a good thing. But then there are vegans who are obviously more doctrinaire and think that I'm a terrible person. It's, you know, you're going to find a mix of opinions on anything that you say or do.
One of the things we love about you is that you think big while you think small. You think about what's on the plate right in front of you, and you think about the political and cultural and environmental implications. If the country adopted this, never mind what it would mean for individual health, but what would it mean for our national profile? I don't know, our economy, our environment, our you name it. If everybody went VB6, motorcycle engine, or diet, what would it mean?
You know, there is this thing called Visual Basic 6, yes, which is a computer programming
yes,
language.
It's got
so
that
if
sound
you want
too
to get into it.
Okay.
You know, the intent of VB6, the intent of this book, and the intent of, a large part of my intent right now on this focus is personal health, because I think there are two ways to look at the stuff about food. One is, what can I do for myself?
Mm-hmm.
And this is about that. You're asking the question of the big picture question. And the big picture answer is, if we were to cut our consumption of junk and animal products in this country by even a third, it would have an enormous impact. And you know that or many people know that a great deal of greenhouse gas is generated by industrial livestock production. A great deal of healthcare costs, $150 billion a year or more, are a direct result of eating junk food, drinking soda, and so on. So in addition to, you know, and if we were to be producing less corn to be used as high fructose corn syrup or less corn to be used as animal feed, less soybeans, fewer soybeans to be used as animal feed, we'd be using less fertilizer, we'd be polluting the Gulf of Mexico less and our streams and rivers less, there would be enormous change.
You're parting the waters. You're showing us the way. Cross here.
It's not... That's very nice of you, but... It's known to many people that the production of junk food and the production of animal products takes far more resources than the production of plants. Basically, the more you process food, the higher up the food chain you're going. Because if you're eating corn, well, you're growing corn and then you're eating it. If you're eating corn and then you're processing it and you're taking some part of it and doing something else with it, and then you're turning that again into something else, and then you're
eating. There's a bunch of diesel fuel in there, and there's a coal
power plant. You've got more waste, and so on down the line. So, the closer we get, you know, the funny thing about VB6 is that I get a lot of questions about the paleo diet. The funny thing about VB6 is that it's actually pretty close to a paleo diet because, correctly interpreted, a paleo diet means you eat meat on feast days, basically, because you were lucky enough to catch a buffalo.
We're lucky enough to catch Mark Bickman, our paleo man, our VB6 man, is with us tonight before a live audience at the Paramount Theater in Boston. We have got a ton of questions from the audience here and from around the country. Mark Bittman's new book is VB6, Eat Vegan Before 6 to Lose Weight and Restore Your Health for Good. We will get to your questions right after a short break. Mark Bittman, it's great to have you right here. Audience in the hall, it's great to have you here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point with Mark Bittman, the great food writer from the New York Times, author of plenty of bestsellers and a big book right now called VB6, Eat Vegan Before 6. We're broadcasting, taping before a live audience at the beautiful Paramount Theater in Boston tonight. Welcome to On Point.
It is an incredibly beautiful theater.
It is a beautiful theater. It's a beautiful night. It's great to be with all of our listeners. We love to get out into the communities where On Point is broadcast. We've been in Nashville and L.A. and all over the place, and this is our home audience. So it's especially great to be here sharing this conversation with Boston and the nation. Mark Bittman has written about food at so many levels, what to put on your plate and what our choices around food mean for our lifelong health and for the health of our environment, for the health of our planet. He goes at issues big and small. We've got tons of questions from around the country and from right here. But the big one I want to put to you is you've been working on this for a while now. I mean, you came into food and you started to see the political picture. And you've been talking, and a lot of other people have been talking about the changes we need to make. And they seem so drastic, almost impossible, when people like yourself began talking about them. But there is some change going on here. You can see it in restaurant menus and diets in people's homes and in the way people think and talk and act on food. How much do you think we've turned the dial on the American way of eating, of approaching food? Have we done 1% of what we need to do? Have we done 30%? Have we made a significant dent in it? Or, you know, when we're not talking to you and thinking about you, are we right back to the chow line of, I don't know, beef and white flour?
Well, I think we're closer to 1% than 30%, sadly. If we were doing something visual, I would be drawing, but
okay.
I can't do that.
Draw
but,
in the air.
But if you imagine
medium.
A bell curve,
yes,
I'm sure you're quite skilled at describing things
on
air. I'm not. But if you imagine a bell curve, I think we've just sort of come up a tiny bit from the bottom of the bell curve.
Okay.
So our diet has been as bad as it will be, and things are getting better. And in part, that's just consciousness. I mean, whether restaurants are serving better food or not, or whether food television is really worthwhile, which is something one could debate, food is more in the consciousness of people than it's been for a long, long time. And one of the gratifying things that I see when I'm out on tour is that I do see people cooking, and I'm meeting people's kids who are cooking. And that's what's really great, because people You know, I'm 63, and the people of my generation did at least watch mostly our mothers cook. And people were cooking then. But we've gone through a period of 30 or 40 years where kids were not seeing their parents cook that much. And I do think that's changing some. And I think everybody who's involved in this stuff, everybody who talks about eating better and growing better food and so on, knows that cooking is an integral part
just
of that.
Just the simple act of cooking. Why?
Well, because once you engage with your food, first of all, you know, this was a hilarious web thing this week about this woman who made her own high fructose corn syrup, which turns out
to that's
be
so great.
Like an amazing project. But if you were to make a chicken McNugget, for example, you would really have to work hard to make a chicken McNugget. Yeah. I have to find all this stuff that you don't normally find.
Chemicals not in the counter.
But if you wanted to produce the progenitor of a chicken McNugget, that is a breaded piece of chicken, you need three ingredients, basically. You need breadcrumbs, chicken, and oil, or something like that. And when you're cooking at home and you see the sort of very basic fundamental things that go into making the kind of dishes you like to eat, you recognize that you don't need 30 ingredients to make something that really traditionally was made with three ingredients.
Okay, we've got questions from somebody, and this kind of goes to Mr. Bittman.
I love that.
Yeah, you feel very august now. How can people of a middle-class lifestyle achieve this balance, achieve this diet? And I don't know what that means exactly, but maybe it means life is hectic. How do you, how do you afford it? How do you make it? How do you find time to cook it?
I think it's code. And forgive me, whoever wrote the question, if I'm misinterpreting you. I think it's a code for how do we eat organic and local, but yet we haven't talked about eating organic and local. I think there's a sense that when you start talking about eating better, and this is a two-pronged answer, forgive me if I go on for a second. Yeah. When people start talking about eating better, there's an assumption that you're talking about eating organic, eating local, and so on. And of course, there's nothing wrong with that, except those foods are expensive. But the first choice that people need to make is not between an organic hamburger and a not organic hamburger. It's between a hamburger and a head of broccoli. And and it's not about whether that head of broccoli is organic or not. It's that it exists. So the important thing is to start changing your diet into a way where you're eating more plants. Now, once you're eating less processed food and less meat, you actually will have more money in your budget because that stuff is expensive. And so I just wrote this column last week. If you eat less meat, you actually can eat better meat because you're spending less money. You can buy 3 pounds of $7 meat, or you can buy 1 pound of $20 meat, and it costs the same amount.
How do you know
money.
If that 1 pound of $20 meat is worth it? How do you personally figure that out? There it is. It's on the shelf. It's in the cooler.
I think you're supporting farmers who are stewarding our land in a way that we want it to be stewarded. You're supporting farmers who are treating animals in a way we'd prefer.
But how do you know that? When you buy a cut of beef in New York City or Manhattan, how do you know?
Well, the closer you can get to buying directly from a farmer, the more confidence you can have. But how do you know that the meat you're buying in a supermarket doesn't contain arsenic and doesn't contain antibiotics and doesn't contain pesticides?
We don't.
It probably does.
Yeah.
And yet people buy it all the time.
But that's easy to do because that's the mainstream.
But
just know your purveyor,
and there is some faith involved. I mean, there is still a government, by the way. I mean, it's not much of a government,
I was looking for that just yesterday.
There are still inspection services, and I think that
organic or grass-fed.
You know, in Canada, they don't test organic. In the United States, there are some tests as to whether things are
good,
and there are rules. So, you know, to some extent, producers in general follow rules. I mean, not always, obviously, but there is some faith involved. But if someone says something is grass-fed, if someone says the animal was raised without antibiotics, there's a way in which you may need to just believe that.
Here's a question for you from Facebook. This is from Ayn Marx, like Ayn Rand, only different, except having a little fun. Does vegan before 6 mean that I can be tendentiously self-righteous until 5:59 p.m.?
You know, this is why it's unfortunate in a way to have to use the word vegan, because people think, you know, there's a chain of vegan restaurants in L.A. now, and you walk in and you think you're going to find a bunch of, forgive me, I just, this is terrible.
Be kind
to
vegans.
Let's just go on to the next question. Okay.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. Okay, Christine on Facebook says, cool, I have a 9-year-old son, wants to be vegetarian. My question is, when trying to substitute vegan things for regular things, is it really more healthful when the substitute things are kind of chemically, like using margarine instead of butter, or vegan cream cheese, quote unquote, that kind of thing? We're beating up on vegans here.
No, we're not beating up on vegans, but I think we're beating up on processed foods. We should be beating up on processed food. And vegans are capable of eating junk food just as non-vegans are capable of eating junk food. Look, Coke and French fries are vegan. So the word vegan has to imply, to me, it's a convenience word. And it implies, it's talking about unprocessed plants. You can interpret it in a much different way. If you say, I'm a vegan, I don't eat animal products, and you say nothing about what you do eat,
yeah,
that's a problem.
Follow up on that, maybe then, just straightforward. A listener asks, how do I get my children to follow your diet, Mark Bittman? It's not Cocoa Puffs.
It's not. You keep the Cocoa Puffs out of the house. Say, well, your choice this morning is fruit salad or oatmeal.
Will they hate you when they grow up?
My children tease me to this day about how their lunch, you know, and I didn't even think that I was particularly interested in health when my kids were young, but evidently they were forced to go to, according to one of them at least, they were forced to go to school with whole wheat bread, peanut butter sandwiches, and an apple when everyone else was coming to school with, I don't know what, Big Macs and...
Yeah,
and,
you cruel, and, cruel dad giving them a healthful lifestyle.
And 18 cookies, yeah. You know, but...
Is there a vegetable path that you found most effective? Or I don't know, here's the way in.
The tactic is that you teach the kids to eat what you eat because you're eating good food. I mean, what's so odd about that?
Nothing odd, but difficult maybe.
Well, but look, we don't need to get deep into parenting, but parenting isn't the easiest thing in the world. Parenting is work, and parenting is struggling. And
Amen.
Parenting is making value judgments about what you want for your kids. It's not negotiating about whether your kids get Cocoa Puffs or oatmeal. There's no Cocoa Puffs. Big deal. Yes.
Okay. So here, one more on kids, and then we'll get adult. Ali says, how did your childhood experience influence your cooking?
So that's they're all interesting.
Or maybe
questions.
Your palate.
This is especially interesting question. This is, my mother will undoubtedly hear this, but she seems to take everything very well. I used to say...
Thanks, Mom.
I used to say that my mother was an indifferent cook, and there's a kind of whole long proto-feminist discussion to have around that, but the bottom line, I think, is this. My mother, I don't think she was happy about it, but my mother saw cooking as part of her daily work. And as a result, she put something on the table that she cooked every single night. And it took me a long, long time to appreciate that. Because, of course, when I was a kid, I took it for granted. And then when I became a food snob, I thought, oh, my mother put lousy food on the table there. And now I think my mother went to the supermarket 2-3 times a week, bought food, and made sure that she cooked at least some of it from scratch every single night. And that, you know, that's a fantastic thing.
That was in front of you. Yeah, that was the mom.
Really
yeah.
My
good,
mom!
Good for Mom. I don't think your mom is going to mind that. Okay. Thanks, Mom. Let's go to the other...
We've talked about my kids. We've talked about my mom.
Now we'll get closer to your sex life. Gustavo. Gustavo writes on Facebook... I guess this is off your PBS show. Can anything in this world actually top driving around Spain with two gorgeous women in a Mercedes convertible and stopping in around the country to have the world's best chefs prepare a quick meal for you with Gwyneth Paltrow and Mario Bartali and Claudia Bassols, the Spanish actress? Well, Gustavo, inquiring mind wants to know. How was that?
Well, Claudia is the same age as my older daughter. So we had a, I was sort of an avuncular figure for Claudia. So we had kind of a fun relationship. Gwyneth, I will say, really interesting woman, but dropped in and she sort of jetted in, did her couple of days of work and jetted out.
Oh, Mario Gustavo's and I are, dream is crumbling.
Mario and I are pals. The food was great. The cars, I will say, Mercedes makes some. I mean, you know, I shouldn't, but you know, they make very nice cars.
Okay. They never, so it was all right.
They never broke. They were really fast.
Where's Spain compared to the USA when it comes to eating well? And I mean, as a general rule, you went to all the top restaurants. I don't mean high cuisine. I mean,
I think that Europe, UK. I do travel in Europe a fair amount. I think that. The UK is a sort of different story, but
West, so we've heard.
Western Europe is a harder place to eat well than the United States, actually.
Really?
It's not a harder place to eat really great cooked food in restaurants, but it's a harder place to go into restaurants and try to eat a wide variety of foods. Now, part of that is nice because you go to Italy and you have pasta and you have contorni and you have meat or fish.
But is that the reason the strength of tradition is so great there?
Yeah, to some extent.
That's
true, but in a way Spain and France are really the most difficult because they don't really eat vegetables in those countries. It's really strange. In restaurants, they don't even. At home, they do, but in restaurants, not so much.
USA, it's going to have to be us. Okay, here's one from Anna here in the hall. I'm curious. Oh. Is Tom, what do you rely on to keep your energy up for your show? What do you eat for breakfast? And what does Mark think of your breakfast habit?
Now that we're living together.
Okay, here's my breakfast. It's absolutely routine. I don't know. But I mean, I'm trying. It's every single day, it's always the same. It's Greek yogurt with some fruit. It's a piece of whole wheat toast and a glass of orange juice.
Well, the orange juice, I would cut back on the orange juice.
But I love the orange juice.
Orange juice is like soda in a different form.
Yeah, that's why I love it, I think. Oh, what about the energy piece? I got to be like busting like a maniac when I'm at 10 a.m. Eastern time.
You do need sugar to live. I mean, your body needs sugar, but your body wants sugar in small not frequent, but steady doses. It's almost like what your body would like would be this teeny tiny little IV drip of sugar. That's
oh, no, so you don't know my body. And my body wants an apple pie.
You have a glass of orange juice, and, you know, your body goes wild. Woo. Your insulin spikes, and an hour later, you're passing out.
So
you're eating a Milky Way at 9:30.
Yeah, but I'm not. I don't eat again until 2, so somehow it works. I don't know what makes that happen. A couple of walnuts in there, but I'm okay except for that, so...
Well, I'm not here to judge anyone's
diet. You're Mark Bittman. You are the judge. You are the judge.
You don't throw anything on the floor of all of this stuff you're
I got some on the floor back here. What are your go-to canned goods, if any? Sam wants to know.
Sam, canned tomatoes, absolutely essential. And I'm finally getting to go to a canned tomato factory later this summer.
Is that a big thrill for you?
That may change my mind about them. But, I mean, there are things that are not in, you know, you need a well-stocked pantry with olive oil and vinegar and soy sauce and things like that. But most things are actually not, I can't really envision a lot of things in cans besides tomatoes.
Chemical issues?
Canned beans are okay.
Kristen asks, thoughts on BPA in canned beans?
Well, that's starting to go away because although the government is too cowardly to outlaw BPA, the manufacturers are recognizing that consumers would just as soon not buy stuff that's canned with BPA. So that won't be, I don't think it'll be an issue 5 years from now. I mean, it's unfortunate that it's still an issue now.
Consumers are going to save themselves, whatever the government does, by their choices, by companies responding.
Well, this goes back to the question of personal versus political. Consumers will make some choices. Consumers will vote as they did, you know, as they did in Connecticut, and they will elsewhere. Consumers will vote to have GMOs labeled. Consumers will decide not to buy canned goods with BPA. Consumers will continue to increase the amount of organic stuff they're going to buy, and government industry are going to have to come along. But consumers can't make everything happen.
No.
We really do need regulation, and that, you know, that's a lot of what I think about and write about is what's the sort of mix of what can we hope and expect the government will do for us.
We'll come back and look at regulation. We'll look at the farm bill. We'll look at the food we eat. Mark Bittman is with us, author of VB6, Eat Vegan Before 6. We are live before a wonderful audience at the Paramount Theater in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Great to be with you all here. We've got more questions. They are pouring in. We'll be right back with Mark Bittman. Stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook before a live audience in Boston, and this is On Point. My guest is food journalist and author and all-around big thinker, Mark Bittman. His new book is VB6, Eat Vegan Before 6, to lose weight and restore your health for good. He thinks about the big food issues, and he thinks about the food on our plates. Those plates have been changing in the United States. He and others have been leading that charge, and a lot of people in train right now. He's with us tonight. We've got a lot of questions from our audience here in the hall and from you around the country, and we're very happy to put those to him. Can we talk for a minute about meat? I grew up on a farm. It's a seventh-generation farm now in Illinois. I've lived in Boston for a long time, but I go back there religiously. I love it. It is the family farm since 1818.
So cool.
Same place, same farm. My cousin farms it now. Let's talk about meat. When I grew up in a time when it wasn't industrial meat production. You know, we had cattle and we had hogs and we had sheep. Those were my particular job on the farm. We had chickens. We had, you know, everything. And then the fields had a lot of diversity. You had oats and you had barley in addition to corn and beans and you had wheat. But the livestock in particular, it wasn't industrial. And when we took sheep to the slaughterhouse, I knew those sheep. I knew them individually, you know, and sometimes if you needed $50, you'd just take one. And it would be me, you know, 12 years old in the back of the pickup holding it while my dad drove to the slaughterhouse. That is very different from what we see today.
Wow, that's a fantastic story.
Well, I mean, that lamb went to market, you know, with a 12-year-old kind of teary-eyed and singing a little song in her ear. I don't think that's how it works very often now.
Helps me understand you a lot better.
Does it? Okay, we're getting closer. But you've just written about meat, and you're thinking about it. You haven't banished it from your life. It's very much there. You alluded to this, but what's your strategy on meat now?
You know, I'll answer that question. Yeah. But that description of a farm is so not what happens now.
Oh, I know. I go back, and it's all changed.
I don't know about yours, but there, of course, are farms like that now. But that was the norm. You know, you're like,
it was
what,
everybody's
70,
farm.
75?
No, I so, turned 87 last day.
But that
this
was the
this,
norm.
This was the 60s
was
and 70s.
Multi-crops with animals.
Yeah.
And this does make sense because animals, I mean, one of the reasons, there are many
great.
Reasons
Horses
I'm not
and
a vegan.
And everything.
But one of the reasons I'm not a vegan is that animals are a part of a sane agricultural landscape. There is a way in which some of the stuff that you grow is better fed to animals than it is fed to people. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the waste from animals is really helpful in fertilizing land. So there is a very simple and very natural cycle towards having animals
I would drive the manure spreader day after day in the spring, out it would go, and that would be the fertilizer.
So what is my relationship to meat? We need to eat less of it because you can't produce the system we have now where we raise and process either export or kill and export or kill and eat something like 8 billion animals in the United States per year. And we're talking about hundreds of millions of cows and pigs. That kind of efficiency, and I'm doing air quotes for those who are listening, that kind of efficiency is the only way to produce the amount of meat that we're eating now, which averages 0.5 pound per person
per day.
Mm-hmm. If we were to produce meat the way your family did, the way small and medium farmers are doing now in more traditional settings, there might be only enough meat for us to eat, say, 1 pound a week or 2 pounds a week. Mm-hmm. Or I mean, it's hard to know how much. But that meat would be higher quality. It would be have less impact, less damaging impact on the environment. We'd be contributing less to greenhouse gases and so on. So it does make sense in a way to choose quality over quantity to improve the livelihood of farmers, to improve the lives of animals, to improve the quality of the meat we're eating, and we can do all of those things only by eating less of it.
We talked about individual choices. We'll talk about government regulation, but just, was it last week, big company out of Shanghai buying Smithfield pork for $6 billion or making that bid for it. Very likely to happen.
I think it'll happen.
What about the influence of that? This isn't just an American decision anymore.
The irony is that the quality of the meat will probably improve because they're
in China.
Yeah. Well,
but it's not going to cut back on industrial pork production in this country.
No, it's not going to cut back on industrial pork production, but the Chinese were not importing some of that pork because the producers were using chemicals that the Chinese didn't want to have in their meat that we were willing to have. I mean,
there's
countries all over
the
world that don't buy American products, American meat products, because they're raised too shabbily for other people to want to eat them.
Even China,
even
with 1,000 dead
yes.
pigs
well,
in the river?
By the way, GMOs are labeled in China, too. I mean, there's all kinds of weird stuff going on. We are not, you know, we have the image of being a forward-thinking country,
clean, yeah.
a country that does things right. And we, you know, maybe we were that way at some point. It's hard to say, or it's a long conversation. Mm-hmm. But right now, we are not in the forefront of anything in that regard. You know, there are countries who do much better. I mean, tobacco labeling is an interesting thing. If you want to talk about lifestyle choices, there are countries who have lower alcohol limits for driving than the United States.
All of Europe.
But if we're talking about only food, there are countries who are starting to really, really limit the marketing of junk food to kids, which is one of the places that this has to start. And one of the ways this is going to change is to make it not so appealing to kids to eat junk food from the time they're 2 years old on.
Can we talk about the Farm Bill and talk about regulation and points of leverage here? Farm Bill first. It's something's going to happen this year. It has to. It didn't happen last year. I guess it will now. There's a lot of money in there for support for SNAP, Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program.
Food
we used to call
stamps.
Food stamps.
Yep.
A lot. I mean, we did a show on it recently. I was surprised. It's by far the big. Something like $50 billion out of 90, or 60 out of 100, or it's enormous.
It's more than that, but yeah,
even more. But what do you think of the bill overall and where it's taking us?
I mean, food stamps are what's called an entitlement. You talk about politics.
Yeah, well,
I mean, I
sure.
didn't know what this meant until I started writing about these kind of issues. But an entitlement means that the program doesn't have a ceiling on it. As people need food stamps, if they qualify, they get them.
And a lot of people have needed them during the Great Recession.
A lot of people need them because there's a recession. And as a result, the amount we spend on food stamps grows. That's
okay. We get through the economic hard times. People get to eat. Farmers are paid for their crops. I mean, in a way, that works.
Right.
What about the rest of the bill?
Well, the rest of the bill is very... You know, I have a friend who taught a course on the Farm Bill, and she said to me at the end of the course, I felt like I knew less than I did at the beginning of the course. So it's really, really complicated. But one of the things that's not so complicated is that there are things called direct subsidies, which are payments made to farmers. 90% of them are big-time farmers. And they're payments that are made whether they grow crops or not. And that's something that many people have argued against over the years.
And some of those have come down, in fairness.
They've come down a little bit, but what's happening now is this kind of bait and switch where those subsidies, the direct subsidies, by the way, I disagree with you. I don't think we'll see a farm bill passed this
really?
Year. But the subsidies...
Why? For a principled reason? For a political reason?
No, I don't think they'll get through it.
So they'll just
roll
it forward,
they can
same deal.
They can do extensions, they can make minor tinkering, but
don't we do anything anymore?
The Senate and the House are really, really far apart on these two things, as they are on so many other things.
Yeah.
And I do think, this isn't my bailiwick, but I do think they want to get to immigration, and they actually do want to pass something
one thing
on
at a time, maybe.
So
all right.
They're going to wash their hands of this thing. But there is this... There's this bait and switch where they're talking about getting rid of direct subsidies and instead they're going to heavily subsidize crop insurance, which basically will encourage big farmers to plant crops anywhere and everywhere. And if those crops are damaged because they were planted on a hillside and the hillside got washed away, or they were planted in a drought, an area was likely to be hit by drought and it's hit by drought, they'll be paid for those crops anyway. So that's, again, this is not a program that's going to benefit small farmers.
Do we need to fix or change the Farm Bill or our government posture toward agriculture to change the way Americans eat and change our environment ultimately?
Well, we have to attack things from both directions. Yes, we do. Yes, we can change our diets by ourselves, And yes, we need government help to be growing different foods, to be looking at agriculture in a different way, to be creating, or shall we say, improving a food system that really is not designed to benefit consumers. It's designed to benefit big producers.
You said if there are going to be subsidies, let's shift them to smaller farmers, organic farmers, farmers sort of on your path.
I think that's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is to say, why don't we subsidize, or why don't we look at making it easier for people to buy fruits and vegetables, having them in more places. You know, there's a lot of talk of food deserts,
yeah.
Which is not, there's some argument about whether that's a useful term or not, but the fact is there are a lot of places in the country where people wind up shopping in convenience stores, and in convenience stores, it's really hard to buy real food. What if that food were more widely accessible? What if that food were subsidized so that it was paying farmers a fair price for growing broccoli? Broccoli's always the example. And for whatever reason, I don't know, but it's symbolic, it's green, it looks like a
veggie.
Fruit vegetable, yeah.
The herb veggie.
And make sure farmers get paid fair prices for growing fruits and vegetables, and make sure consumers can afford them. That's a kind of subsidy that would really be beneficial.
Regulation, if you could wave a wand and bring on one, two, three, what would they be?
I think I would start with a tax on soda. I think that that's an experiment. It's not clear that it's really...
Is Mayor Bloomberg still on board with that after all?
40 or 60% of you clapping. But no, which I'm serious. I'm not being sarcastic.
Yeah.
I would start with that, not because I'm positive that that would work, mm-hmm. but because I think it's the most interesting experiment we could do right now. I think within a few years we would see... And there have been some pilot studies on this stuff. As you make it more difficult for people to drink soda, they drink less soda and their health improves. There have been some studies that show that. If we did that on a massive scale, I think it would be a really interesting thing. And we'd be getting some income which could then be used for public health education, to subsidize fruits and vegetables, for any number of things.
Okay, there's one.
I mean, if you look
what
at
else?
The tobacco settlement, we made it much more expensive and much more difficult for people to smoke cigarettes. And the money
and
that the tobacco companies paid to the states was used to convince people to smoke.
Yeah.
To convince people
lay
not
off that
to
soda,
smoke,
kid. So, okay, there's one. Another?
Well, I think of that as two, because I'm talking about taxing and
doing something
and
with the revenue.
Subsidizing. I guess I'd have to think about it some more. I'm hung up on that, and when we get that one done with the magic wand, we'll move on to number two or three.
Okay, here's Dave. His question is, what do you think has caused the increase in childhood peanut allergies? Let me extend that just to all the food allergies we've got.
Yeah, I don't.
What's going on?
I don't have a good answer to that question, and not only do I not have a good answer to that question, the people who study allergies don't have a good answer to that question.
Isn't it strange?
It's totally weird. It could be something in the way food is grown. It could be something in a different kind of environmental damage that's being done to children's bodies. It could be any number of things, and who knows when they'll figure it out. But anecdotally, I mean, I think they're saying that the number of peanut and milk and shellfish allergies are tripling every 6 years in kids, which is just an insane number. And it's up to something like 6% of kids are allergic to peanuts, which is just an unbelievable number. Yeah. And, you know, when I went to school, and even when my kids went to school, everybody brought peanut butter.
Yeah, here, we've got a minute and a half. Helen wants to know, if you're having a dinner party, what is a vegetarian dish that everyone loves? Thank you, Helen.
Tom, you're not taking this seriously.
Yes, I am. And I am. So is Helen.
How about
deliver,
pasta,
man.
Pasta with pesto, for example.
Okay,
you want
we've
more?
Done that.
What do you want?
Yeah,
you
I don't know.
More?
Something a little more. I mean, yes, everybody will love that.
I don't know. Stir-fried vegetables.
Stir-fried turnip and bok choy mash.
There you go.
This spicy carrot is...
My brain doesn't work that way. So, I don't know. It's like it's easier to think of 5,000 than it is to think of three.
You look in the fridge and what's there, or in the cupboard. And
my favorite thing is to open the refrigerator and not know what to cook because there are so many options. Like to have 8 or 12 different vegetable, you know, have eggplant and zucchini, and to have collards and broccoli, and to have cucumbers and tomato, all that stuff, and just say, I don't know what to do. There's so many options.
We're two steps up the bell curve. Are we on the way? Do you think it's going to happen, or are we just going to eat ourselves to death in this century?
Well, we already are eating ourselves to death. We have eaten ourselves to death. So the real question is, can we make it any better? And you have to be optimistic because you have no other choice. I think it'll get better, but I'm not sure I'd bet on it.
You making a difference? You and Michael Pollan and all the rest, you making a difference with your drumbeat?
Well, I guess that's a sort of modesty aside. I like to think I'm making a difference, yeah.
I mean, you're persuading me month by month, week by week. You've brought
me
around.
I will say that I really enjoy the work. So
we feel it. It communicates very well, and I think it's part of what makes people listen to the ideas behind it. Mark Bittman's new book is VB6, Eat Vegan Before 6, to lose weight and restore your health for good, the flexible diet you can really stick to. More than 60 delicious recipes. Mark Bittman, you're the best. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. Mark Bittman, ladies and gentlemen, to everybody in the hall here in Boston, thank you very much. Thanks for coming out. I'm Tom Ashbrook from the Paramount Theater in Boston. This is On Point.
What a joy to do our show before a live audience. It was a great time at the Paramount Theater in Boston. Our thanks to Mark Bittman. And before our conversation, we enjoyed some great music from Boston's terrific young bluegrass band, Della May. I want to share some of that with you. Thanks, Della May, live there with us at the Paramount Theater in Boston. And thanks to all of you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.